This is the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services. The date is April 30th, 2007, 3 p.m. Hearing Room C. Committee Chair, Senator Bill Morrison.
Why do you take that away from me? Services Committee will come to order, please. We have several work sessions today and a bill public hearing toward the end, which may not be very far away. The end is near, so beware.
I wish that were true, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so we're not going to hear Senate Bill 14, and we are going to open a work session on Senate Bill 183. And Dr. Senator Bates, would you please come forward?
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to bring a couple of people up with me who have worked very hard.
Yes,
on
yes, yes, indeed.
Mr. Bates, do you want to?
We can do the five or six. What are we going to do? Go ahead. Introduce yourself, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Alan Bates. I'm a state senator from Ashland, Medford area, and I'm also a practicing physician in that area.
And Mr. Chair, just for the record, Corey Streisinger, director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We'd like to talk to you for a few minutes about Senate Bill 183, the dash 7 amendments to it, which we got about 1:30 this afternoon.
Okay.
We looked through them. We think they're okay. If we've missed something, we'll apologize later and fix it later, but I think we've got it all down now, finally. I'm just going to walk through them real quickly with you. First off, let me say that I think we all know what this bill is trying to do. We've had a rural supplement program for malpractice premiums for physicians for about 4 years. Frankly, that program has been incredibly successful, and I'm very proud of what's done for Oregon, very proud of our governor for bringing it forward 4 years ago. Initially, had $40 million set aside for this program, which was expected to last 4 years. In fact, that money has been stretched now. We expect to get almost 8 years out of it, if not 8 years out of it. It's been successful in keeping physicians in rural areas that we would otherwise lost, but there were some problems with the bill. And living right next to Ashland, Oregon, trust me, I heard about that a lot all last summer. It never ended. That difficulty had to be fixed, but had to be fixed while we were in session. And this bill does that, I believe. I'm going to walk through the 8 or 9 things that the Dash 7s do real quickly for you, and then make a few comments. First off, it grandfathers in areas as previously defined under the Rural Health Act in January of 2004. Remove something called urbanized areas. This is a definition used by the federal government of areas which have a heavy population in them, and it removes urbanized areas from the program. This in essence, takes Ashland out. It requires attestation from participating physicians that they will accept patients in the Medicaid and Medicare areas of insurance at the same level that those classes of citizens appear in their county. By that I mean, if you've got a county with 15% Medicaid and 30% Medicare, that you'll accept 15 and 30% of those into your practice. The reality is, of a little over 1,000 physicians affected by this, when we checked to see how many of them had their practice closed in any way, only 8 had their practice closed. The rest of them had their practices wide open. These are individuals who are frankly doing God's work out in the rural parts of our state. They take anyone in their practice, regardless of their income, regardless of their insurance. They're living in areas that have a very high Medicaid, Medicare, uninsured patients, and that means they don't get paid very much for those patients, but they take them on. They're usually heavily invested in their communities. They know everybody. Everybody knows them. And this is something that's been put in at request of several individuals, but frankly, is not going to have a great deal of effect, I don't believe, because these people are doing it already. It This bill also reestablishes that obstetricians get 80% of their premium paid, that family practitioners doing OB get 60%, and that primary care physicians get 40%. And we include in that primary care physicians surgeons who do general surgery and anesthesiologists, because these are needed to do C-sections for obstetrics in many rural areas where they have primary practitioners who don't do C-sections. All other physicians that were previously affected by this are put on a very steep glide path of 35, 25, 15, and 15% as far as what they get for a supplement. If the program runs short of funds, we have, this bill says we can go ahead and put these people on a bigger glide path, a sharper and steeper glide path, or eliminate them entirely from the program. We really want to focus here on those physicians doing obstetrics, those physicians doing primary care. The other issue involved in this, you'll see in this, in the Dash 7 amendments, is we found something out unusual, Mr. Chair, and it was at your insistence that I looked into this, and I appreciate you being insistent about it and making me go do my homework a little more tightly. We found out that there are still four physicians in Ashland doing obstetrics. They're all primary care physicians, family practitioners. They do their own C-sections. We also found out that they do not have a boutique practice. These physicians are seeing very low-income women, primary from La Clinica Deval, which is a safety net clinic located just outside of Ashland, the Talent area. I further went ahead and checked with the head of obstetrics at Rogue Valley Medical Center. I asked her if these 350 roughly deliveries had to be transferred to Rogue Valley next year, do you have the capacity to take care of them? She says the hospital does, but we don't. We do not have enough obstetricians or primary care physicians doing to take that load on, and we appreciate that those patients are being taken care of in Ashland, and that the Ashland doctors are willing to take on these very low-income and very low-pay patients. On that basis, we have reinserted just the obstetricians in Ashland back into this program. The rest of the physicians in Ashland will not be on a glide path. They'll be out immediately. That is a very quick run-through of the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 183. I hope they meet your approval and that you will go forward and insert them into 183 and pass this bill out to the floor.
Senator Cruz.
Yes. Who's the author of the AIDS? Do you know?
The AIDS of the author is someone sitting very near you, and I put that as a placeholder in case we wanted to try to put general fund in this. If we need it in the fourth year, I've withdrawn the Dash 8s.
Because?
It's going to first be difficult to mix the monies in. We think we have enough money in the third and fourth year to run the program as is, especially if we start limiting people in the subspecialty categories if necessary. And also because we know we have absolutely enough money to run the next 2 years, and we'll be back in session to reevaluate the financial status of this at that time.
I know initially when we were talking about this, we were talking about a general reduction in years 3 and 4 or projected because we might run out of money. And we opined at that point in time that we'll be back here in 2 years. And at some point we're going to need to reauthorize with something probably more stable. And so at this point in time, we are not anticipating any decline for those who are still covered over the next 2 years.
That is absolutely correct.
Okay.
You also find language in here that fixes the premium paid either at the amount they're being paid now, or if the premiums happen to go down at a slightly lower percentage. I mean, the percentage will stay the same, but the premium might go down. But we're not going to be paying them more than they're getting now. An 80% reduction in your, as an example for obstetricians, 80% reduction in your premium is significant. This is really a significant amount of money for an individual physician.
Mr. Chair, if I could,
yes.
Senator, just to keep the record clear, there is a glide path for the non primary care physicians that will modestly reduce their receipts under this bill starting in 2008. So I wouldn't want to leave you with the impression that there's no impact under the Dash 7s. There is an impact under the Dash 7s.
I think what Senator Cruz was referring to earlier, I think both of us felt and discussed that there was not necessarily a need to come to take care of the shortfall this biennium. We're kind of short on other in other areas, and we could come back in the next biennium and take care of the rest of the program.
So
it wasn't necessary to do it this biennium.
If, Mr. Chair, if I have misspoken, to make it clear, the point I believe she's trying to make is that if you're a physician in a rural area right now and you're getting a 40% discount on your premium and you're not in primary care, you're not doing obstetrics, you're not in primary care as we've defined primary care, you will see a reduction from 40% to 35% next year and from 35% to 25% the following year. Those specialties were carefully selected as very high-income individuals, and frankly, a lot of them didn't even know they're getting the discount before. This is a key program for people in primary care, a key program for people in obstetrics, but for specialty care, it is not as important. And that was made pretty clear to us when we had our discussions with people in rural areas. I called around all over the state and talked to those who are recruiting physicians. I talked to people who run healthcare organizations like individual practice associations, IPAs, and that was made pretty clear to me that one part of this is extremely important. Other parts are nice, but not absolutely necessary at this time.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Montesander.
Why didn't you, since they're so high income anyway, why didn't you look at, since they weren't on the program, I mean, they've only been on the program for 4 years, that you eliminate the subspecialties altogether?
That was, Mr. Chair and Senator Mons Anderson, that was part of the discussion. Dropping people off a cliff, sometimes you can always find an individual you might get in some serious trouble with. We are especially concerned about orthopedics and a couple other subspecialties. We don't want to lose these people because of trauma in the rural areas. And we wanted to go a little slower on before we drop them off entirely and see the results. I did not have a chance to call around to 1,000 doctors and say, how's this specifically going to ask, you know, how's this specifically going to affect you? So I talked to, as I said, the IPAs and the FCHIP managers. They felt that a glide path would give them a chance to see what the effect was. They didn't think they'd lose physicians over it, but they weren't absolutely certain, and they wanted to have an opportunity to see how it worked the first 2 years, dropping them down.
It just seems like 40% to 35% is so minimal.
It is minimal, but it gives you enough money to keep the rest of the program running intact. Okay, we just want an opportunity to see how this is going to work before we drop people off a cliff. We're doing it nationally, absolutely. They're not going to get anything there except the obstetricians. But the rest of the state being much more rural, we were concerned. So we wanted to be thoughtful and careful as we roll this program out.
So you're still welcomed home on weekends?
Yeah, but I have to use an assumed name, and I have to go in the undercover of darkness, and I have to leave before it gets light.
You do anyway.
But you do have a safe haven in the clinic, though.
Yes, that's in Medford, and they were never affected.
Oh, no, the birthing center. You could always hang out there.
I suppose. Yeah, in that one group, I'll probably still be welcome.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. Good. Okay, other questions, comments? Okay, are we ready?
Mr. Chair, I move the DAS 7 amendment to Senate Bill 183.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the DAS 7 amendments to Senate Bill 183. Discussion? Comments? Seeing none? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 183 as amended to the floor.
To
the floor. With
wait
a
minute now. Are we going to the floor? It says fiscal, right? No, Senator McGurn, we'll take it to the floor. Good.
With a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 183 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. I better not do that first.
Mr. Chair.
Discussion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Senator Bates and Corey for their work. It's still a work in progress, and I think the discussions will continue as we move forward, and we'll see how it's working, and there's always February for that emergency yet to be determined. So,
thank you. Well, I also want to thank you for your work, and we do have some leeway in terms of adjustments that you're able to make along the way. We could come out even if you make the right adjustments over the four-year period. Secondly, this will give us time to look for a more permanent solution, which we absolutely, totally need to find. And so we do have 4 years to do that. And hopefully that will be folded into the reform program that we're working on.
Mr. Chair, I too want to thank you. I don't know of any area of the state that is more affected than my district. And we have one community, the community of Reedsport, who is literally losing all the doctors, and this is going to really help. And I appreciate very much having that intervention here to try to help us continue medical care on the South Coast.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And nurse practitioners were included now. You forgot to mention that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, can I correct this? We also did something different, and we nurse practitioners, because we're in a situation where nurse practitioners working alongside physicians are actually paying higher premiums than the physicians were. So I apologize for not saying that, Mr. Chair, and especially to Senator Mons Anderson.
Yeah.
Ouch. Sorry.
Right here in the bill.
The other thing that I did in the meantime is I questioned whether or not physician assistants should be involved, and in checking with my own physician, he told me that most assistants are taken care of by the insurance of the physicians, and there were anecdotally at least 4 or 5 who were not covered, but that raised the unintended consequence. If we covered those 4 or 5, then suddenly there may be a whole lot of physician assistants who were not covered. So I just wanted to check that, and I wasn't sure what that situation was, but so we're doing fine. The nurse practitioners, I think, was an absolutely great addition to other comments. Okay. We're ready.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Mons Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Grisham?
Aye.
Chair Marquette?
Aye.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 185 passes.
183.
I just changed the number. I'm sorry. Senator 185, that's the new number. Senate Bill 183 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The Senate debates will carry the bill.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you. Okay, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 931. Would you read the description, please?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 931 was a bill the committee heard on the 16th. It creates a task force for a comprehensive obesity prevention initiative. The committee does now have before them the -1 amendment, which increases the number of task force members from 10 to 13, specifies that the 3 additional members will represent Oregon universities or other specialized groups with expertise in preventing obesity, promoting good nutrition and physical fitness, the built or physical environment, or minority health issues, directs the task force to develop a plan to implement and fund initiatives to reduce obesity and obesity-related disease, replaces the requirement that committee elect one of its members as chairperson with a requirement that the director of the Department of Human Services or the director's designee serve as the chairperson of the task force. The bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. I may have mistakenly said a work session, a public hearing, but I meant a work session. If I didn't say a work session, I say a work session.
That's what I heard.
That's what you heard. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the -1 amendment, Senate Bill 931.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 931. Discussion? Okay. No opposition? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 931 as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 931 as amended to the with a due pass recommendation to the Subcommittee on Ways and Means.
No, the Joint, not the.
We're not going to. Okay.
Can't send it to a sub.
To the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Okay. Call the roll, please.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator
Mons
Anderson?
Aye.
Senator
Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Grisham? Aye. Aye. Okay, it's on its way. We are not going to hear Senate Bill 957 today. We are not going to hear that. We will move. I guess we're not going to hear. We are not going to hear Senate Bill 1031 today. We're not going to have a work session on either of those. So we will move to the public hearing on Senate Bill 766. public hearing. 766. Senator George is going to testify, correct?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, State Senator Harry George representing District 12. As you can see, we have a dash one set of amendments, which basically replaces the bill. We ran into the wall of fiscal costs on this one and objections from the agency, and went back to my office and found this there. And this was a suggestion from the Project Roof. And I don't know if you've seen the booklet, but they had some suggestions in there as legislation, and we looked at it and we said, this is almost perfect. We will, if we can't get a program in place, we'll do a study to find out what the problems are. And if you remember when we heard 766 the first time, Department of Human Services came in and said all of the services listed in 766 are critical to development of disabled and mental health community programs. Then went on to state that there were already the programs that we listed in the original bill were already in place. So we have a conflict as to whether or not we have a problem. So then the idea of moving forward with a bill that would in fact address the question as to whether or not we have a problem became very appropriate. That's what we have before us today, is the dash one amendments. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do we want to talk about the dash one amendments? Yeah, let's go through the dash one amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The dash one amendment creates a task force on Oregon's comprehensive services systems for adults and children with developmental disabilities and establishes membership to be appointed by 30 days after signing day. Requires a task force to evaluate current services for persons with developmental disabilities and develop a comprehensive plan for meeting the needs of adults and children with such disabilities. Requires a task force to submit a report to the legislature by October 1st, 2008. Requires the Department of Human Services to staff the task force. Declares emergency effective on passage and repeals the act on the first day of the next regular legislative session.
Okay. Mr. Bean, would you introduce yourself, please?
My name's David Beam. I'm an advocate for disability people in the state of Oregon. I got phone calls at night. They want services after 5 o'clock. Some of them can't wait till the next morning. Well, what happens when I have an earthquake or a flood or a building burned down? What are you going to do? You can't leave them out in the street. Police and fire stations should be on call 24 hours around the clock, 7 days a week, or on Sunday. Still an emergency. Mm-hmm. State of Oregon should look at this problem. Be the first one in the state of Oregon would serve this all these people in the state of Oregon. There'd be nobody left out in the cold. The legislature would run this thing and make sure it's done. Every county should be involved in the state, and the legislature, senators, be involved. Some of them want them right now in this district, wants it now. But I can't do it right now. I don't have time. I don't have the resources to get the money done. I sent a letter to the White House. Don't like the idea. To the President of the United States. Wants to give me a hand. But I can't go do that because I don't have any resources. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much, David. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Good job. Yes.
If I could, the dash one amendments, you'll see a couple of interesting numbers. More than, in line 6 and 7, more than 5,500 adult and children received 24-hour service. Then you drop down to line 16 and 17, and you recognize that 9,000 individuals with developmental disabilities and their families continue to wait for critical services. I found it interesting, and the reason I thought moving forward with dash ones was a good idea is because we do hear conflicting numbers. The only problem with the conflicting ideas of whether we have a problem or not is to talk to folks like David Beam and others that try to reach out to and service this committee, this community with the most basic necessities of life, is that we really don't know how big the problem is. And you remember from the previous testimony, so I won't go over that, some of my personal experiences relative to the fact that there's such a major unmet need. So I'll be looking forward to hearing the testimony from those folks that are here. But I know many people have a heartburn about more studies, but I'm going to tell you, we cannot make good decisions about any issue unless we have the facts. I think this is a big step forward to get the facts.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I agree. we can't get into a program like this without adequate preparation and fact-finding, and we have to start small with a kind of a pilot project and have to have people on board and in the advisory area, and then we can come back and expand the program, and over the years we can have a full-fledged statewide program, hopefully, but we have to start slow. And you are the one, David, who planted the seed, and you can watch it flourish and grow.
But, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I mean, Legislature, but you got to realize a lot of these people have been waiting so many years. And the legislatures keep saying they're going to help me, mm-hmm. and they'll keep saying no. Now, that ain't right for disability people mm-hmm. put away, and ain't serving them. Mm-hmm. That ain't right either.
Well, we're saying yes, David.
But I'm just saying, you need it. Point these people, get this going. Mm-hmm. I've been working on this since 69.
Okay.
That's a long time.
Good.
And I've been working with every governor we ever had
okay.
doing this.
Good. Thank you, David. Thanks.
Up.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Carol Ann. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you do that? Carol Ann Taylor, please.
Hello, I'm Carol Taylor. I live in Yamhill County, almost. I am a parent of a person who has a disability. She's an adult. She lives on her own with appropriate supports. But we set out to advocate for people who have developmental disabilities. And we also said at that time we're going to work to build housing and advocate for those who can be independent. But we have those in our group, Families United for Independent Living, and six other groups that we've been working with here at the legislature. We've also promised them that we'll try to find an answer for the needs of their kids, their adults. And there are people who need 24-hour services. There are people who need some combination of comprehensive services that we haven't even got in the state of Oregon. What we're asking is to bring the different groups together that can build the service network that needs to be provided, the brokerages, the DHS, the families, the individuals themselves who may be able to speak, or they may have advocates who communicate on their behalf. But what we're asking for is a system that can be planned for, as everybody does best when they can plan, and parents certainly age out, die, and they want to be able to plan for their person who needs comprehensive care. And there are many whose parents are getting up in their 80s, and it's only reasonable for them to expect to be able to work with someone to figure out how to care for their child, and it's only reasonable for them to be able to figure out a way to have services for their child, adult person to be cared for in their own area around people that they know, so that they can arrange services that do the right thing for this person, so they can be in a place where they fit. Right now it's crisis driven. Your parents die, something happens. You can go to Bend, lovely place, but you know, if you're from Portland, mm-hmm. it doesn't fit. And we're just asking you to look at things, work together, have the legislature behind us, so that those parties who aren't maybe ready to make a change, mm-hmm. we'll get on board and work together so that we can get some reasonable solutions.
Are you involved in the facility in McMinnville?
Yes. We did the work for that one and worked with Barbara Pine at Oregon Housing
yes,
and Community Services.
That's a model. That's kind of a pilot project in itself. That's
it is, and that's for people who are adults who can live independently with mm-hmm. some supports, with appropriate supports.
Yeah.
And we found that people do much better when they have the supports they need and they can live successfully with fewer supports than one might think. When they have the right combination of people working with them.
Mm-hmm.
People who now are in comprehensive care at a very high dollar figure,
mm-hmm.
for example, in the Pendleton situation, they may be able to do just fine with a different set of supports in a different community. But the state right now says it's going to be done this way for a few people, and that's the way it is, and we want to look at making some changes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
DC Winters. William Dalton.
I'm David Winters, a helper to David Beam. We just wanted to have the David Beam's letter written that we wrote and in the record. And the key part of that is on the second page, second paragraph, dealing with the accurate information that Senator George was talking about, that we need accurate numbers of who's being helped, who's being turned away. If I understand the way the office works at senior and people with disabilities, the person has to be evaluated before they can get crisis services. And so how many people are prohibited from getting evaluation due to whatever reason, lack of finances, whatever. So a complete tracking of numbers, I believe, is very important to get to the what the real need is.
And that's the way it is, and we want to look at making some changes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
DC Winters. William Dalton.
I'm David Winters, a helper to David Beam. We just wanted to have the David Beam's letter written that we wrote and in the record. And the key part of that is on the second page, second paragraph, dealing with the accurate information that Senator George is talking about, that we need accurate numbers of who's being helped, who's being turned away. If I understand the way the office works at senior and people with disabilities, the person has to be evaluated before they can get crisis services. And so how many people are prohibited from getting evaluation due to whatever reason, lack of finances, whatever. So complete tracking of numbers, I believe, is very important to get to the what the real need is. Because underneath the way I understand it to operate, the lady that was blind, deaf, mute with the baby couldn't get services because she couldn't get on the list. And they suggested, well, that she went around to different places. They said, well, just another thing, said, we'll take the baby. She can come back later, which meant never. So anyway.
Thank you for raising that point. Yeah. Okay. Is that it?
Yes.
Thank you very much, and we will enter this letter into the record that David Beam wrote. William Dalton.
Hi, I'm William Dalton, here from Salem, Oregon, past administrator for services for the mentally, emotionally disturbed, developmentally disabled, also a consumer. And I guess my testimony falls under the rubric of Mark Anthony type testimony. Because I appreciate the need for the clarification of just what we're trying to address here and the actual needs that do exist, much like David Winters was saying. Certainly the financial fiscal impact, it's essential that we have an understanding of what the issue is and what the scope of the problem is before we can talk about allocating funds even for an effective demonstration project. And in reading through the wording about how we constitute the study group, I feel very encouraged because of the breadth of input that's going to be existent even on the study group itself, not even talking about who might be called in to give testimony. But I have a great big however, that I want to share after those positive comments, and that is I want to share my disappointment about the fact that it appears that this study group is going to be constituted specifically to look at developmental disabilities. Throughout my 30-plus year career in mental health and developmental disabilities, I've recognized that some of the worst problems we run into, and this is also true when you throw in the additional problem of addictions, is that we tend to draw boundaries around what we do, particularly when we're resource poor. And the thing that most excited me about the original way that this proposal had been constituted was that it was a significant effort in writing to try and reduce the boundaries and recognize that some of the greatest problems that we encounter, and even you as committee members encounter by your own testimony that you shared and the comments that you made weeks ago, are with those people who are falling between the cracks. Certainly the testimony today has reminded us of two major problems, one being 24-hour services, the other being comprehensive services, and both of those we seem to experience some lacks. In fact, even at the end of the testimony of the person from Human Resources a couple of weeks ago, I believe she was kind enough to admit that, no, even though it's on paper that we exist to provide this breadth of services, the truth is we recognize that we aren't doing that. The testimony that we've heard, the comments that have been elicited even from the committee, my own experience in the field here in Oregon for a couple of decades, indicates that the problem is far broader than just developmental disabilities. And I myself would feel so much more encouraged if the same kind of study that's being proposed, with the same kind of appreciation for how the committee is constituted so that the voices that need to be brought to the table can be heard effectively. I would so much appreciate it if we were to broaden the perspective and the scope of this study beyond just the developmentally disabled. I think Carol Taylor's testimony was brief and eloquent in terms of the unmet needs, the concerns of both the developmentally disabled population and the people that care for and about them. But I dare say if we had more people here from the mental emotional disturbance community, the mental health community, however we want to label it, we would hear those same kinds of concerns. I've been a member of NAMI for 20 years, a National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and I've heard some of that same eloquence on behalf of those people and have recognized how so often those people, and even some with multiple diagnoses, are the first ones to fall through the cracks. So if I was in a position at all today to have any influence, in addition to my thanking you for taking steps that would allow these issues to move forward, I would request that you broaden the study so that it would more comprehensively include the very people that are most likely to call you at home at 10 o'clock on a Saturday evening pleading for help. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Senator Ramona Sanderson, did you want to comment on that? It seems to me you were thinking along those lines that...
Well, we have sent quite a bit down to Ways and Means already for task force, and I can't remember. Anyway, all of these bills that are asking to work on task forces, there are a number of them now in Ways and Means. It'll depend on how they combine them all.
Well, I guess what I... The reason I mentioned this to you specifically is you were thinking along those lines for the mental health. Is that
mm-hmm.
true? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you're... when we had a meeting before, she mentioned that this bill was similar to one that she was working on at her committee.
Okay.
Now, the the thing that will make this bill happen is the fact that there's a very small fiscal impact. And I don't know that there will be no fiscal impact, but it will be very small, and we can get it off the ground. And again, I think it's something we have to build on. Now, there are other bills there that could be combined. That's a possibility when some of these bills are heard. There's a very, very strong feeling about the mentally ill. And while we are planning a new institution where we don't have the local infrastructure to match the new institution, and so we have to do them at the same time. We just can't build a new institution and fill it up right away. We have to plan from the ground up. And so what you're talking about, I think, is part of that plan. So I think what you're talking about will be addressed as well. So
may I comment?
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm really encouraged to hear those comments. I'm not completely savvy in the way that the state government OS works. I've been on a governor's task force or two and had some involvement. But I think any words from you all in support of the studies and the people involved in these studies being asked to coordinate and collaborate would possibly save us an additional 2 years in terms of being able to move forward with respect to the finding of the studies, because if we have two excellent groups develop two excellent studies, then I think 2 years from now we're going to be sitting here saying, now what we need to do in the name of effectiveness and efficiency is find a way of identifying the overlaps as well as the gaps between these two constituencies. Whereas if we take the next 2 years and have the study groups not only work hard with their specific assignments, but to also collaborate in terms of examining these issues, they may be able to put us a step ahead in terms of the follow-up that we can do.
I think so.
Thanks very
Good.
Much.
Thank you. David.
Yes, D.C. Wunder. I find all the comments very encouraging, and Bill Dalton's presentation I found very helpful too. That David Beam and I do want that to be broader than just developmental disabilities because of the needs.
Yeah,
people are so we're in favor of that. And I just wanted the other was the we feel that consumer run facilities are critical to making it really happen in a positive way and keeping the cost very low.
Mm-hmm.
On page 2 of our testimony, we mentioned the Federal Clearinghouse that has considerable documentation on how much lower cost consumer-run things and supplementing the other things that you're talking about would help keep the long-range cost considerably lower. And so that's why we included their 800 number and website and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Carla Cudmore, Lynette Norrie. Lynette Norrie. And Gordon Pfeiffer, would you come up, please? And then we have three more after the three here, and we will move this bill. Who wants to go first?
I will. My partner may not last very long. My name is Carla Cudmore, and the kind of the noisy one back there is my daughter, Kaylin. We're from Polk County.
Okay.
Kaylin's 20 years old, and she lives with us at home, and we hope she will for many more years. Throughout my testimony, I'll refer to Kaylin as both an adult and a child. As she is 20 years old, she's legally adult, but she'll always be a child. Kaylin functions at the 12 to 18-month level. She can't walk or talk. She can't feed herself. She can't use a restroom. She requires extensive lifting, and she has limited use of her arms, grand mal seizures, and she can't be left alone. We love her dearly, but she requires a lot of care and strength. Until now, life was really possible because Kaylin has been in school, but soon school will be over. Luckily, we have brokerage services, which will financially allow Kaylin to attend a program 4 or 5 hours a day during the week. There are, however, many hours left in each day and week that she must be cared for. She has to be cared for all hours. Who's there to do that? Her father and I. I'm lucky, though, because Kaylin's dad is still in the picture, and many of my friends' husbands are no longer in the picture. In fact, two of the members of our group who were supposed to be here with us today, both are single moms, and they have sick kids today, and they have no backup, so they're at home. I'm one of the sandwich generation. For years, I was able to work part-time and attend my other kids' sporting events because my mom came to live with us, and she was my source of respite and sanity. Now I'm providing care for my mom, who is legally blind and in the grips of dementia. As you can imagine, as a result, work for me is becoming harder, our family's finances are becoming more tenuous, and depression for me occurs all too often. Mm-hmm. One particularly rough day last week, I was worried, realizing how life can change overnight. And I'm anxious about the future. And what would happen to Kaylin, I called up my case manager, and I asked her, what would happen if I told you I can't take care of Kaylin any longer? And she said, well, you'd be deemed in crisis, and Kaylin would be placed in 24-hour care. Would this be in Dallas, Kaylin's town, I asked? Well, we would try to keep her up to her party, but that might not work out. Well, would Kaylin be put on a priority list to come back to our community if that happened? Well, not necessarily. If placement was working out where she was, she would stay there. And yes, that could mean in Portland. So would we have a choice where she lives, who she lives with, who her friends are, her caretakers? No. My worst fear is exactly what happened to my neighbor were a reality after that phone call. The state knows that parents will do anything in their power to prevent a child like Kaylin from moving far from home without their friends, their families, their supports. We're held hostage. For every year that we hold on at home with our kids, the state saves money. I support Senate Bill 766-1, the amendment, because I believe we must start thinking now what will happen to all the severely handicapped adults living with their baby boomer aging parents at home. Agencies across the nation are worried about who is going to take care of all the baby boomers in their retirement years, but who is planning for all the disabled kids of all those seniors? The current system is already crisis-driven and allows no choices or options for people like my daughter. It has to stop. The purpose of the group created by Senate Bill 766-1 is to look at the comprehensive system for adults with developmental disabilities and see what it's doing well, what it's not doing so well, and begin to make recommendations to find a truly comprehensive approach to solving the 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week needs of the children and adults just like Kaylin. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, after listening to my friend Carla, it's a little hard for me to talk. We have known each other for a long time. Our friend Maria and Linda are...
Introduce yourself, please.
I'm sorry. I'm Sylvette Noray, and my daughter, Anne-Sophie, is going to be 24. She's living with us. She has a progressive developmental disorder of unknown origin. She functions pretty well some of the time and extremely poorly some of the time. We can help her function at her best level with a lot of care, a lot of planning, a lot of support that we can put in place. And we have done so for the last 23 3/4 years. Just before my daughter turned 21, we were not receiving any services. And we had to say that we would bring her to the county office in order to get some services that would allow me to continue working and providing health care for my family. We got services about a month before she turned 21. believe me. After 2 years of services that allowed me to work and care for my family, our services were cut back because the grid that was used to provide services to us was retooled. And I didn't lie. Yes, I do sleep 6 hours a night. I cannot function with less. Yes, sometimes my daughter wakes up in the middle of the night. I'm just too tired to wake up. So we went into crisis again. At that time, we were shown a place where my daughter could go, and I realized that it could happen that my daughter, who is emotionally 3 years old and maybe intellectually 7 or 9, but physically a woman, might share an apartment with a man. Nobody thought that was wrong. At that time, we decided we would go into crisis at home. Thank goodness some people in the field were dedicated and got us another program that helped us get services again 6 months later. So all we ask is to be able to take care of our children as long as we can, to get some services that we can continue working, continue to provide food and shelter and health insurance for our other children, and also those college tuition that we do not get any breaks on. And that when we are no longer able to provide services, services to our children increase so that we can keep them close to our lives, we can keep them involved in their brothers and sisters' life, we can keep them in their community, we can let them go to the church they have attended for many years in spite of their disruption or disruptive behaviors. And so that's all. We're not asking for more. We're asking for things to happen in a planned way as we are no longer able to provide as much as we have done so far. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator George, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, there's some statements in here I'd like you folks to respond to them. Whereas the provision of comprehensive service is the responsibility of all Oregonians, if the state is to improve the living conditions of residents with developmental disabilities, and it would apply folks to folks that are facing mental breakdown problems and things like that. There's no question. I think this could also be applied very easily or broadened when it gets to the other committee. And then the next statement, which is right above it, says, whereas families of individuals with developmental disabilities should be able to request support in meeting the individual needs and preferences. If I was going to write this, I would say without going into crisis. In other words, there should be that kind of support. I think we all recognize by the heads that are nodding out there that we have a deficit. And I'm going to tell you, it's so amazing. I talk to people from every political perspective. In fact, I mentioned to David today, both Davids, it doesn't make any difference if you're a Republican, a Democrat, or a Nazi, or a communist. Everybody agrees that this is an unmet need. And I really think that we need to get in there and define what the problem is, how big is it, and what do we do to address it. But, I mean, these ideas of not being able to have the support, I see the emotional trauma that you're facing right now, both of you, because you don't feel that there is a support service to back you up when you do get close to crisis. Would you guys care to comment on that, or have I already gone on too long?
It's a fear that if you do end up to the point, I mean, something as simple as no longer being able to lift would put me into a crisis. And so what would I do with my daughter? And to imagine that I may have, you know, she's like a baby. You have a baby and somebody's going to take her and throw her up in Portland and I maybe never give her back down here. Or else I do become 80 years old. She's still living with me. And we're in a crisis because there's no planned system of crisis right now. You can't say, there's no list saying, well, in Polk County, we know Kaylin Cudmore, in about 10 years probably is going to be needing this and this and this kind of service. There's no list out there so that you can even go out and say, okay, Polk County, we know we're going to have to build this many more houses and supply the staffing for this many more places in so many years. It just doesn't exist. And so that scares me, because if I would be 83, then I'm the 80-year-old woman driving up on I-5 to go visit my daughter in Portland, and that's pretty scary too, because I've seen my mother try to drive before she got bad. But anyway, it is. It's just a plan to increase how things are going to work so that people aren't afraid. And I don't know. Everybody has a different story though, and everybody has a different idea what they need, because we're all different, obviously. So.
Well, I think for me, I would like the services to be cost efficient. It really doesn't make any sense for the state to cut us down from one budget for a few thousand dollars, put us into crisis, and then my daughter costs twice as much. What? I mean, this is like penny wise, pound foolish. Most of the time, I can have everything well placed so that my daughter's behavior are under control, and we don't need that much help. But once in a while, when everything breaks down, in spite of my best efforts, I want somebody to come and help me, not to have somebody tell me, well, you just call the police. What would that help? That would not help. My daughter would be even more scared. And she would cost thousands of dollars. But if I could say, okay, when I need it, somebody will be there. I can call. There's a backup. Then I can keep taking care of my daughter. That's all.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Gordon?
Gordon Teifel from Aloha, Oregon, Washington County. I bring with me Barak Teifel and my wife Carolyn. Barak is 24. He needs help with all living skills. And we understand what that means. The last two nights I was up to check on things. And yes, I had to redo the bedding and then eventually get back to sleep. This is what 24/7 can mean on the overnight shift. I speak as leading two nonprofits. I handed out the first letter, the dear letter, Daytime Enrichment Activities and Recreation. It's a nonprofit with directors who have the same profound level of son or daughter with developmental disabilities. And it is our vision to establish a program, a small group inclusion program, so that they can excel at some daytime activities outside the home, rather than go to an ATE, an alternative to employment program, and have far fewer of their specific needs met. So we gang up together, we form nonprofits in order to meet our children's needs, because we don't see those needs getting met in our county. I also represent Families for Independent Living, and for most of 10 years, this nonprofit has been advocating for affordable housing and supportive services for all adults with developmental disabilities. What we've not been able to figure out is the 24/7 puzzle piece. We've not been able to connect the dots for my family to put Barak into the community. There is only the crisis mode. I cannot vote him off our family island unless the island becomes dissolved from some dysfunction. That's an exasperation. Not having a wellness progression into the community, into a music-themed 24/7 group home that he could flourish in. Music is a passion. He's a very sociable person, too, even though he's a non-speaker. It's a compelling music-themed sociable program that would meet his needs. The Comprehensive Services Study Group can help figure this out, can give us hope, where since July 27th, 1999, he was put on the DD wait list for services. And then this year in January, he was put on the Section 8 wait list in the county for a Section 8 voucher. None of that will happen until we're broken. That's not a good thing to look forward to. I want good choices for each of these families to make a wellness progression into the community. So I speak in favor of Senate Bill 766.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for being here. Thank you. Catherine White, Mary Lee Fay, Mary Lee, Barbara Farrar,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I am here on behalf of the Developmental Disabilities Coalition. In the year 2000, advocates sued the state of Oregon under the lawsuit Staley versus Kitzhaber because of the years and years of wait lists for people with developmental disabilities. And for many of you who've been in this building for some time, you remember the horrendous hearings. This is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the issues of families waiting for services. The settlement agreement that resulted out of the Staley lawsuit was a series of compromises. On one hand, thousands of individuals who are waiting for services received some in-home support services. Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Developmental Disabilities Coalition. In the year 2000, advocates sued the state of Oregon under the lawsuit Staley versus Kitzhaber because of the years and years of wait lists for people with developmental disabilities. And for many of you who've been in this building for some time, you remember the horrendous hearings. This is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the issues of families waiting for services. The settlement agreement that resulted out of the Staley lawsuit was a series of compromises. On one hand, thousands of individuals who are waiting for services received some in-home support services. The flip side of it was that only 300 individuals over the period of the Staley settlement, which ran from 2000 and won't be completed until 2009, only 300 individuals had access to 24/7 services. I think the testimony you've heard today is a very powerful example of the individuals waiting for 24/7 services, for whom their needs are not going to be met by simply providing some in-home service. At this point, we are very much in support of the Dash 1 amendments. We believe that the issue of what happens with comprehensive services for people with significant disabilities in itself warrants a very close look. There's currently a great deal of activity that's going on around the comprehensive system, and we're not in favor of duplicating that activity. We do not support recreating models of services that resulted in institutions that we've spent such a long time getting rid of. But we strongly support the establishment of a planning group to develop creative, person-centered models for comprehensive services that engage full family participation. We support learning from our mistakes that our system has experienced in the past and searching the country for best practice models, and we support active participation of families involved in this planning. We're entering a whole new era of services, and I can just speak from very personal experience. Many of the individuals currently in our comprehensive system came out of institutions and don't have active involved families, and many current providers don't know how to work with active involved families. I think what we're talking about here is developing a new way of looking at services to provide support to individuals with very significant disabilities who require 24/7 services. And I think that this is an important endeavor. We make a commitment to increase the involvement of advocates in this effort. This is basically a funding issue. This will be a funding issue. Our lack of 24/7 services for individuals who are not in crisis at the moment is a funding issue. And we make the commitment to be involved in this planning process as a coalition and to be very involved in presenting some budget proposals in the coming years. Thank you.
Thank you. You've heard from some people who are in need of respite help. Is respite help available in Yamhill County for these kinds of situations?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, respite is a grossly underfunded support in this system. We don't have providers who are trained to provide the respite care that we need. Families don't have access to the funds to support respite. Respite is one part of a comprehensive system that we need across the span in mental health, seniors, developmental disabilities.
This would be a specialized kind of respite care, right? I guess what I'm saying is that for an elderly person who needs some assistance and the family requires respite, the person providing the respite doesn't have to have necessarily special training, but for respite care for severely disabled children, there would be need for special training. Is that correct?
Senator Moore said yes. That is what we would
yeah.
like in the
okay.
best of all worlds is some specialized.
Okay. Well, I was thinking, as I've heard the testimony, that you know respite care would be welcome if it was available. Okay. Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair. May I ask
yeah.
a question? Where are the major nonprofits like Easter Seal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I think that nonprofits like Easter Seal may provide some support services, but really what we're talking about here is 24/7 services, day and night supports to families. And I think that within the brokerages and within community organizations, we often find that there are some supports available to families. But what we're talking about here is that ability to do long-term planning that says, I'm going to be involved in my child's life, but I cannot continue to do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I can no longer do the lifting. Nonprofits, churches, community organizations are there to provide some supports, but they aren't the solution to providing that 24/7 service.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Yes, thank you for that response. I understand what you're talking about. I fully understand that.
Well, I appreciate that.
But what I guess I'm trying to get my arms around a little bit is that some of the stories that I've heard today and some of the comments is that I haven't heard anyone really mention some of the major work. They do an awful lot of major work, have a huge facility, have lots of activities and things for
It's not respite in the sense that everybody comes and parents are able to go off to the movies, or it's not a camp. Well, we had a camp at Goose Bay, but I raised an awful lot of money for Easter Seal for about 15 years, and so I was troubled that I didn't hear that in any of the conversations. That does not duplicate a task force or the concerns of families as to what is going to happen to this precious loved one that they have, that they've cared for, when they no longer are here or no longer can care for them. And that is a serious concern, and I would no way minimize that. But I just, even in the list of the makeup of the task force, I didn't see any representation of major nonprofits, which really surprises me.
Senator Morissette and Senator Berger, I think that as we look at what comprises a quality life in the community for an individual with significant disabilities, those kind of nonprofits are a part of creating that quality life. And so I would hope as we move forward, those kind of community resources would definitely be considered.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Barbara Forer, and I'm here from Washington County. I'm representing a population of parents who have kids with developmental disabilities. My daughter is 36 and is mildly developmentally disabled. I'm also representing Families for Independent Living, and I'm here not to repeat some of the testimony that you've already heard about the fear of being in crisis. I think that's been represented very well. But I want to bring testimony that about what Families for Independent Living has been privileged to be a part of in developing the Bridge Apartments, which opened in May of 2005. And it was specifically for housing for folks that were capable of independent living. My daughter was on the wait list for housing and services for 12 years, and I was one of those parents who pretty much gave up. And I had felt the fear of crisis coming, like what you've heard today. And fortunately, she is living on her own. She's been doing that for 3 years now. And the Bridge opened, and I've been privileged to see both my daughter and 14 residents at the Bridge learn how to thrive, because they've been put in a supportive environment that meets their needs. And Families for Independent Living has yet to discover what it takes to provide that same environment for people to thrive, for folks who need 24/7 care. And so I'm here to ask today that you would be encouraged to vote for this bill that would just take a first step in looking at the problem and defining it more clearly, so that we might give more people the opportunity to thrive. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll have to visit the Bridge.
Please do.
Where is it located?
It's in McMinnville.
It's in Beaverton. It's in Beaverton.
Oh, okay.
If you're familiar with Beaverton, 141st and Allen.
Okay. Okay, I guess I don't know why I thought it was in McMinnville.
Our sister organization, Families United for Independent Living, has a place in McMinnville.
Okay. So there is a place in McMinnville. Are they similar?
They are similar. We actually discovered quite accidentally our two organizations were on a parallel path, didn't know we existed until we were both about a year away from opening the facilities. And it really just points out the need for more networking, more cooperation statewide, for organizations to get together and create something more comprehensive.
So did the Community Housing and Development, Bob Repine, help assist in both projects?
No, he was really focused on the McMinnville project.
Okay. Did you receive some assistance from the state?
The project was, the land was granted by the City of Beaverton,
okay.
And the funding for the facility, it was HUD funding.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So pass through. federal dollars?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear there are two projects, and I think both of them are pilot project models for emulation in other places, and I'm from Lane County, and I've talked about the McMinnville project to people in Lane County. I have a friend whose sister has brain damage, and she is in an adult foster home. And it's very good service, but there are some problems, and she's moved out of the adult foster home for socialization. Well, if you have your kind of facility, you don't have to be moved out for socialization. It's built in. And I think that's the great part about these programs, is an individual can thrive as a human being and be with friends and can have their socialization right in one place. And so I think it's a great, great idea, and I'm very, very supportive of them.
Thank you.
Hey, Mary Lee. Okay. You're
good afternoon, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. I'm Mary Lee Fay with Seniors and People with Disabilities, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Developmental Disability Services, and here to provide input to Senate Bill 766. I think from the testimony you've heard this afternoon, we would definitely agree that the issues of trying to plan for and develop for services for people in a comprehensive system services is a very critical one. When we talk about comprehensive services, actually there are two types of services, comprehensive and support. And comprehensive are those services that we're, the resources that we get from the legislature to provide that 24-hour care that's not just residential. It's also about employment or day activity, includes transportation, the case management that's involved. It's a very big system, and it's the majority of our funds from this from our allocation are directed towards these programs. There are 75 residential agencies and another 85 who provide vocational services. Some of them do the same agency, do the same services, but we have a lot of small nonprofits throughout the state that are involved in developing comprehensive services. In the last few years, we've also been able to identify how to support individuals in their own family home through comprehensive services, not having to leave the home. So I think we've been able to broaden and an understanding of what the services are and how they can be developed. The issue has been around resources and support. And I'm sorry I didn't think to bring to this committee, but in our Ways and Means presentation this afternoon, we have a handout, and I'll make this available to the committee, that talks about the two separate services, support and comprehensive, with the crisis being in between. Because what happened when we ended up moving into the support services settlement is what we said is the resources we would be utilizing is we basically did a different public promise. Prior to the settlement, we had a public promise to families and individuals with disabilities that if you wait long enough, that when your time is up, then we'll be able to provide the full 24-hour wraparound service. And that wait exceeded 10 years and 15 years to the point where it was meaningless. Many families never even got on the wait list because, as you've heard some testimony today, the access off it really was there was no light at the end of that tunnel. When we started with support services, it was a different public promise. It basically said, we'll be at the table with you, that we'll take a look at what's happening in your community, what you're now using for supports, and the state funding and the federal funding will be a part of that plan. But it has a cap on it, has a financial cap on it. And those are the services that we've been building over the last 5 to 6 years. There have been, since 2001 when it first began to date, there are about 4,500 people now in those services. But they aren't based on individual needs. You'll find as you look around the room today, individuals who are living home with their families who have the same needs as individuals who are living in our 24-hour residential. And the way we managed those resources was saying we can't turn our backs on people when they're in absolute crisis. And that becomes the gateway. That becomes the door into our other 24-hour services. So it's how we manage resources and how we identify and plan for additional resources. Ms. White mentioned that in the settlement agreement, out of the 5,000 people that are in comprehensive services, we plan for additional 300, a very small number, to have access to services outside of crisis. We've moved of that, the last 150 will move in this biennium. We have an oversight committee. That oversight committee constitutes families, self-advocates, brokerage staff, county staff, provider staff, kind of the group of our community has been doing the planning and development with us since the inception of the brokerage services, and they will be assisting as we do plans for the remaining 150. But beyond this biennium, that's the last group that has an entitlement as part of a settlement. It's not that we don't know about the need out there, but how to identify the resources that will be needed beyond going for that purpose. So we definitely can support being able to look at how will we identify the issues, how do we move forward, how do we make sure we're using the services that we have in the most effective way. I think we have started several new types of models in the last several years that are a combination of working with families and having agencies bring in staff and support them. We'd like to continue to develop that model. We, as Ms. White said, there are a number of groups who continue to look at this service, and we wouldn't want to duplicate or end up diverting certain groups. Some of the activities that we are looking at with funding from a CMS grant, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, are the whole infrastructure of how we do payments, how we look at assessments, how we look at individuals and identify what the cost of care will be in a 24-hour setting. It's a large grant, and it's going to be a monumental impact. We're actually beginning field testing in July of a tool that we'll be using that will be using it with 400 individuals this summer with a hope to field test it by a year from now. So all of those things we could see converging together to help us put together a picture to bring to those who make decisions on how resources are spent on how to best use those resources.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Senator. Mary Lee, I am getting really frustrated. When I read this, I think you're opposing this.
Oh.
When I listen to your testimony, I think you're opposing the whole idea of finding out exactly where we are.
Chair Morissette, Senator George, I'm sorry you got that impression. I think we have to be somewhat neutral when we provide our written testimony, but we think looking at the whole comprehensive system is a good idea. We're actually at the table now. I think our only concern is that we would not want to try and have one process we don't want to duplicate efforts. We have a lot of people who have been at the table working with us on many issues, and we would support that group in, and we would work with any committee to do this.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think it's very clear that this bill involves them very strongly, mm-hmm. and they would, in fact, coordinate all these groups. I think that the key is, the last time when I asked you the question, you have 24/7 answer, well, no. All right, we now have folks saying that, well, you just used the example of 10-year waiting list. You cannot believe that we are meeting the needs of this group. With that in mind, why not have a clear definition of where we are? We're all big, we're adults. We can understand it. If we see there's a great unmet need, even conservative Republicans like myself will step up and say, we got to do something about this. Okay? I think it's important, it's critically important that we know where we are. I don't think we know where we are. I can tell you as a pilot, you want to know where you are all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know where you are, you ask for help. Okay? I'm saying ask the people who know what the problems are and coordinate with them to make sure that we don't have duplication, but a really beautiful product of definition.
Chair Morissette, Senator George, I agree. I think what I was saying is that we do, there are some work committees that include many of the groups that you've already referenced that have been participating with us and really helping us identify that. Not only just the what do we need to do to meet it, but making sure that the types of services that we're identifying are meeting the needs of the individuals that eventually will be getting those services.
I did have a very brief conversation before the meeting. we talked about this in Ways and Means today, right down the hall, same topic. And I don't see it as a duplication. I see it as another phase, another facet of where we're trying to go. And I don't see it as something that is going to be conflicting. I think it needs to be complementary. And I think that we can make it happen. And my conversation with Mary Lee was not that she was opposed to it. She was not opposed to it. I don't have that feeling at all. I mean, it's just that the department has, you know, a plan that's a parallel plan that may, in fact, make a lot of the things that we're talking about happen. And so I think this is a complementary program. Thank you very much for...
Mrs. Chair?
Yes.
I say this to Mary Lee... In with the most kindness. I'll preface my comment with that.
Don't be prepared. Then.
Sometimes when we are working in government, and I'll include myself in this, we get so busy in the rules and restrictions and the process and the way things are done and all, and it's just human nature. We lose sight of the human face. And I think that when you bring people together from all kinds of groups, you come out with exactly where we are, a directory and so forth. And we shouldn't fear that. I would hope that the agency wouldn't be afraid of the outcomes of that kind of thing. The thing that gets my attention is anyone being on a wait list for that long. Sometimes people need respite. Rather than waiting until they're desperate and in crisis, a little respite all along the way would help a great deal. Not that you're not going to go to 24/7 in your planning, but you don't have to wait until people are just absolutely burdened and on the brink of completely giving in to their own physical, mental, and emotional stress that they have. So I think that we should be very open to this kind of process. I'm very open to it, and I think that if it means changing some things as a result of it, then we should look at that very seriously and change things, because I think that we, as long as we can remember the human frailty, the human part of us, that any one of us could be where any one of these families are today. And so I think that I don't know that you fear it, but I don't think we'll come out with something that's not complementary or duplication of services, because I think that you're going to be aware of what's happening, and all you have to say is, well, we already have that service. So that gets on the list if the service is already provided. So that's my comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, yes. I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 766.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 762. Discussion.
766.
Discussion. Seeing no discussion. So moved.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 766 as amended to the floor for the passed recommendation. To the Committee on Ways and Means with a D-Pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves 766 to the Committee of Ways and Means with a D-Pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Senator Monty Anderson.
Excused.
Senator Berger.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Vice Chair.
Aye.
Chair Martek.
Aye. Thank you. Close the work session, and we are adjourned. Thank you.